The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. We are back after our little early summer hiatus. I am Neil Pollack, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. I've got two segments with film critic Stephen Garrett this week. Stephen was in Cannes for the film festival, and he rounds it up for me. And I'm also going to talk to him about Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, which was also in Cannes, but is also in many, many theaters all over the world right now. And I've seen it. And so, Stephen, we have some thoughts about this bombastic summer blockbuster that is now filling your screens. And I'm also going to talk to TV critic Omar Gayaga about season two of Nathan Fielder's The Rehearsal, which just concluded its run on, I guess it's now HBO Max again, not Max. And it's quite a TV ride. And Omar and I have a lot of thoughts about Nathan Fielder and what he's up to. But first, Stephen Garrett is going to report. He's not in France, but he's going to report from what he saw in France. And I'll talk to him right after this. Like the swallows returning to San Capistrano, San Juan Capistrano, Stephen Garrett returned to Cannes this year, and he is here with a report. I believe this is like the fourth or fifth time we've talked about your trip to Cannes on this show.
It might be, yeah, for sure.
It's almost like you go to France every year to see movies or something.
Yeah, it seems every year, yeah. For some reason, I end up there.
Yeah. What a coincidence. Well, good. All right. So what did you stumble upon this year? And how are things in Cannes? Was everyone like, feh, America?
No, you know what? It was the head of the festival, or at least the face of the festival, is this guy, Thierry Frémaux. And he is very French. He basically sleeps in a tuxedo, and you see him every single day. And he has boundless energy. And he jumps up the stage and he goes, bonjour à tous, you know, and like welcomes you all in. Scarlett Johansson was there with her directing debut, Eleanor the Great, which is a very sweet, kind of straight down the middle sort of debut, directing debut. I don't think she's trying to be too fancy about it. June Squibb is in it, 95 years old. She's great. But anyway, Thierry Frémaux introduced Scarlett Johansson, and he made a point of saying, we love America. We love America, but almost like pityingly. Like,
yeah,
we don't love it quite as much as we used to, but we still love the people in the country.
Everyone feels sorry for us, and I'm like, don't cry for us, Argentina. Come on, cut the shit.
But there's a lot of skepticism about the tariffs. There's a lot of like, I don't understand how this is going to work, and he's probably forgotten about it already, and let's just make movies. So
yeah. All right. Well, that's good to hear. So what did you see? How were the movies this year?
I thought the movies were pretty solid. There were no things that really knocked me off my feet. You know, like there was years ago when Parasite played and Once Upon a Time in America, and they played on the same day, one after the next. And like, it's hard to get those kind of highs when you're at a festival like this, despite the fact that it being the most kind of prestigious, quote unquote, or certainly in demand festival everybody wants to play. The thing that won the Palme d'Or was a pretty powerful movie by Jafar Panahi, this Iranian filmmaker, you know, kind of dissident filmmaker who was jailed for decades, or I think for about 20 years, got out a bit early. But while he was jailed or imprisoned, he still made movies.
Yeah, we've covered him quite a bit on the site. And he won the Palme d'Or this year.
He won the Palme d'Or. And, you know, it was for a movie about a bunch of people who think that they have captured the person who potentially was torturing them in prison, interrogating and torturing them in prison. So it's a bit of a Death of the Maiden type thing. Not the most original idea, but he lived it. So you got to cut him some slack. Very powerful.
Yeah.
And there is some doubt as to whether or not he actually is the person. And there's a lot of soul searching and emotional torture, as well as reminiscing about physical torture. So powerful Palme d'Or winner.
Sounds like a laugh riot. And it was the sixth... It was the sixth year in a row that a neon movie won the Palme d'Or.
It did, which is astounding because I think before them, There was literally no American distributor who had a Palme d'Or winner 2 years in a row, let alone 6 years in a row. So
what's going on there?
I think a lot of wise choices, sound judgment, and a little bit of luck. You know, I think, you know, like the first time they won was for Parasite.
Right.
And that was a film that they had a relationship already with Bong Joon-ho, and they helped produce the film. They financed it. They had it a year before the festival started. The jury changes every year, so it's very hard to game the system.
And so, and the other ones were Anatomy of a Fall, Triangle of Sadness.
Yep.
I can't quite name the other.
Teton.
Oh yeah, Teton.
And Anora.
Oh,
now
gosh.
All of those movies we just mentioned were films that Neon had started to finance and agreed to distribute a year before the festival. It's not like they swept in and picked it up.
Right.
These were deep investments, deeply rooted, and then got into the festival and then won the Palme d'Or. So it's hard to really handicap that.
And I will say this, you know, other than Parasite, which is, you know, forever sort of a classic, and Anora, which won Best Picture. I mean, the other movies I would classify as, they're distinctly art films. Like, those are not movies that, you know, Teton Mania, as much as I liked Teton, it did not sweep the nation.
It did not. It wasn't even submitted for the foreign language film that year.
Yeah. So what was the Jafar Panahi movie this year called?
It was Just an Accident. Mm. And
really could be a sequel to Anatomy of a Fall, right? With that
exactly.
All right. So what else did you catch this year?
Well, I'll just go down the award winners really quickly because those are the ones that will get the most buzz. The second place prize is called the Grand Prix. Now, that went to a film by Joachim Trier called Sentimental Value. He was the guy who did...
The one with the Danish woman running around.
The one with the Danish woman running around. And that Danish woman is in the film again.
Renata Rencivi or whatever.
Renata Reinsfeld, worst person in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Worst person in the world, Renata Reinsfeld. Renata Reinsfeld's in this as well, as is Stellan Skarsgård, as is Elle Fanning. So it has a bit more name recognition and also has some English language spoken in it. So you could see that translating overseas, at least the United States, incidentally.
Also kind of a romantic comedy, like Worst Person in the World?
No, not at all. Actually, it's a generational story about a father and about a house. It's interesting. There were two movies this year about experiences in a house over the space of like 100 years. Mm. This was the, the Norwegian version of this. And Stellan Skarsgård plays a late in his life filmmaker who's estranged from his two daughters, divorced the wife early, left the family, wasn't really in touch with them. The mother dies. He wants to patch things up with the daughters and has written a film that he wants his daughter, actress daughter, Renata Reinsfeld, to star in. And that is the drama, basically. It's very touching and very well done. Incidentally, Neon did, you know, they a year ago picked it up and helped finance and brought it to the festival.
What's that called again?
That is called Sentimental Value.
Sentimental Value. I'll look for that at the Film Society. That's I'm certain where that's going to show up.
Well, look, it might. No. This might break out a bit more just because it does have familiar faces and English language. So it's very accessible. It's very mainstream. The jury prize, which is the third prize, was a tie to very, very diehard art house movies, which will shock me if they break out in a good way. It would shock me. One was called Sound of Falling. This movie by Masha Shalinsky, a German filmmaker. This was the other movie with the house over 100 years. It shows this kind of generational dissolution of bonds. And in a weird way, it also, and there are a lot of women that it focuses on in that family. And it struck me almost like a Teutonic virgin suicide. So they're all weirdly or either vaguely or very much obsessed with death. Death all around them, maybe killing themselves, like blah, blah, blah. That's Sound of Falling. The other one was Surratt by Oliver Locks. Spanish filmmaker. This was co-produced. I think one of the producers, rather, was Pedro Almodovar and his El Deseo company. This is the weirdest movie of the festival. It was one of those that played early, and it was one of those where every conversation started with did you see Surratt? Surratt, not the artist, but S-I-R-A-T, which in the film is explained as the bridge that connects heaven and hell. It's sort of a weird mix between, it's like Coachella meets Mad Max, right? Because there's a lot of like electronic music and people dancing and people just rhythmically moving to music. And then basically it seems like World War III breaks out and they're all in this desert in Morocco And a couple, the police come, or the military come, to escort them away out of the desert. And three or four trucks break off and go rogue. And one of them is being driven by a guy who's trying to find his daughter, who is like, my daughter's in a rave in Mexico. I mean, in Morocco. I have to find her. And that is the gist of the story. It's weirdly riveting, despite the fact that there's not much story. And at times it feels like Wages of Fear. At times it feels like William Friedkin's Sorcerer.
Well, those two are the same movie. So I would hope.
Yeah,
I would
basically hope so. This is a weird movie and it works and it's crazy. So hopefully that'll really catch fire.
All right, speed round. Anything else?
Speed round. Brazilian film by Kleber Mendoza Filho called Secret Agent. He did this crazy movie called Baccarat. This is somewhat equally crazy. He won Best Director for the film and also Best Actor. I think the lead was the guy who plays the lead in Narcos.
Okay.
What else? Oh, in terms of American movies, Ari Aster's new movie, Eddington, played.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very mixed. I kind of dug it. It's his sort of take on COVID, life in America during COVID. It was like, you know, circa May 2020.
I'm going to have strong opinions about that.
Yeah, I think everybody will. Also, there's a movie called Die My Love, which has Jennifer Lawrence and Robert Pattinson. Jennifer Lawrence plays a woman in the throes of postpartum depression. It's directed by Lynn Ramsey. Very expressionistic, very impressionistic, not really concerned about narrative plot points. It's easy to get lost, but Jennifer Lawrence's performance is crazy. She's literally throwing herself through like plate glass doors, you know, and anyway, it's totally nuts. Robert Pattinson mostly just looks stunned in the movie, but she is going to go to Matt for this. She is going to try to pull out all the stops to get a, you know, Oscar recognition for this.
Another Oscar.
Yeah. And if I could just mention one more.
Yeah.
I mentioned Scarlett Johansson making her directing debut. Also making her directing debut was Kristen Stewart with a movie called Chronology of Water. She's been working on it for the better part of like 8 years. Finally is finished. It is so Kristen Stewart, this movie. It's very, it feels at times at its worst, it feels it's a pretty good movie. At its worst, it feels like a very insecure film student who's trying to impress and provoke at the same time and show them, you know, show the viewer like, I know how to edit really crazy and I know how to direct really crazy and do crazy sound design. Anyway, but then when the movie calms down, the star, Imogen Poots, this is a movie based on a memoir by Lydia Yuknatovich about her sexual abuse at an early age and then her wayward life and then how she found her voice as a writer. And Imogen Poots' performance is incredible. She's fantastic. So Kristen Stewart actually is talented as a director as well as an actress. This will be one to watch.
All right. And they're also the most significant American opening of Cannes was Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, which we will talk about in a few minutes. We're gonna switch gears and talk about television. I'm going to talk about television with Omar Gayaga now. And Stephen, I want you to just go back to the green room. You're going to put some Nutella on some toast or whatever they do in France and have a smoke. And we'll be back in a few minutes to talk about the new Mission Impossible movie.
I've been studying commercial aviation disasters as a hobby. And I started to notice a disturbing pattern in the causes of these crashes. 15 years ago, you recommended role-playing exercises. The FAA
said no. For whatever reason, they're just not going there.
I do have some experience with creating elaborate role-playing scenarios. And I do have money to put towards this.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there.
Let's work together to save some lives.
Nathan Fielder's The Rehearsal is one of the most polarizing shows on television. I try to get my wife to watch it with me, and she says she just can't. That Nathan Fielder makes her too uncomfortable. This season of The Rehearsal, season two on HBO, would have been especially difficult for her to watch because she's terrified of flying, and the entire season revolves around it's an extended joke or riff on airplane disasters and why they happen. But I don't feel the same way about Nathan Fielder or The Rehearsal. I find it, I find his work extremely relatable and extremely brilliant. And I watched every episode of the Rehearsal sort of on the edge of my seat, even while nothing real was happening. Omar Gayaga is a frequent contributor to Book and Film Globe. He writes about a lot of things for us, but he's especially astute about comedy. But I have to admit, that I was kind of nervous about talking to Omar Kayaga about season two of the rehearsal. So I staged several practice conversations with actors who were playing Omar Kayaga. And I feel like I'm now, after that, I think I'm ready now to finally talk to him. And Omar is here today to talk to me about season two.
I mean, if that's where the budget needs to go, yeah, sure.
I had an unlimited budget given to me by Sea of Reeds Media. By unlimited, I mean no budget, or my usual budget, which is close enough to no budget.
Unlimited, yeah.
Limited budget. But Omar is now here, and I think I feel comfortable. Not only that, I've also talked to you many, many times before, both on the show and in person. So I think we're good to go.
Great. Well, I'm glad this process is working so far.
Yeah. And Omar is a real person. He's not an actor playing himself, although he is also an actor.
Sometimes.
And so am I sometimes. So really, all reality is blurred. And especially when you're talking about the rehearsal. So let's talk about this season, Omar, right? The first season of the rehearsal was sort of an extended riff on a Nathan Fielder's neurosis about not having a family. I would say, and he sort of created this fake family for himself to practice becoming a dad. But the stakes are a lot higher this year because I couldn't tell. Do you think he's really concerned about airplane crashes and airline safety?
To spoil the finale, or can we spoil the finale, or should we not?
Well, I don't know. Let's talk about this issue first, right? I mean,
that it goes with my theory of like why this show is and what how it came to be, and it's hard to say, it's hard to talk about that without what happens in the final episode.
All right, well, we'll just talk about it because I feel like, you know, I didn't actually know what happened in the final episode before I watched it. I finished watching it about 5 to 10 minutes before we're talking now. I think it's still a gripping hour of television, a really excellent hour of television, both sort of as comedy and drama. So go ahead. Reveal what you got to reveal in order to give your theory.
Okay. Well, this entire season has been preoccupied with air safety, and you know he's talking to experts. He's hiring pilots. He's trying to get into the minds of pilots and solve the issue that he believes is communication between pilots and co-pilots. That is what's causing some of these crashes. So that's sort of the thesis for the whole season. In the final episode, the finale, episode 6, we find out that he has, in fact, for 2 years been flying and getting pilot's licenses and getting other licenses with the eventual goal, which we didn't know about till this last episode, of flying a plane full of passengers.
Actors.
As a pilot.
Actors playing passengers.
Yes, actors playing passengers.
Because legally he wasn't allowed to fly paid passengers. He was, as you put it, the least qualified person in North America to fly a 737.
Right. So this sort of flips the script on the whole show as far as what is his interest? Why is he doing this? And my theory then is that he just got really into flying. He got, you know, he wanted to be a pilot of planes. And I think the idea got bigger and bigger, and somewhere along the way, it's hard to tell if like the horse before the cart, whether like he had the idea for the show and then said, well, it's going to take this 2 year commitment of becoming a pilot to do that. Or if in the course of just doing pilot stuff on his own, he came upon the idea of, oh, you know what? I'm seeing this disparity of communication among pilots. Maybe that's a thing. And then pursued that to its very illogical.
It was very illogical.
And great distances. Yeah.
And the twist of twists is that in the end, he actually does this in his spare time. He flies empty 737s to whatever their final destination may be. You know, something about like flying across the Atlantic Ocean to Namibia, and you see footage of him. He's actually doing it. He actually becomes a pilot.
So that becomes kind of the great joke of the season is the lengths he went to basically feed a hobby that he got into. It's my theory is that he got really into flying and then found a way to shape an entire show and concern and thrust of comedy at it and throw all this money at it. And I think it served both of those purposes. It kind of fed into his interest in piloting and air travel, but then also does raise this concern that he may have come upon along the way. So yeah, I haven't read any interviews with him since the finale, and so I don't know if he's explained any of that or kind of what idea led to the other. But it's elaborate. It's a lot. There's a lot going on this season.
You can't really believe anything he says anyway.
No.
The fact is that he does do it. I believe that he actually, I mean, there's no way they're going to, he actually flies the plane, which is was shocking and extremely tense in its own way and well done. You know, as tense as any ridiculous stunt that Tom Cruise may have pulled off in Mission Impossible involving airplanes, because it was real. And I loved it. But, you know, there a lot of the familiar Nathan Fielder themes come up in this season, right? He, like, the sort of uncomfortability of human communication, the phoniness of television and of reality television, and then, of course, like, awkward male-female relationships, a lot of that.
A lot of that, and among pilots, there was an entire Canadian Idol-style mini-show within the show.
Mm-hmm. Wings of Voice.
Wings of Voice that paid off in the finale with the performance. And also the kind of what crept in the last maybe two or three episodes was this idea as he was sort of, one of the tangents of the show was getting involved with it with an Alzheimer's society.
Autism
organization. And then this floating, this idea that maybe he is autistic, maybe he has autism. And then that would explain a lot of the tics and the mannerisms and the social awkwardness that he's built his whole career on. And that sort of becomes a cliffhanger going into this last bit is, should he even be flying if that's one of the things that would get him flagged as a pilot,
right?
Were he up to fly a commercial plane?
Right. It's a sort of another joke within a joke. Also, let's not hide the fact that he manages to get HBO to pay for a detail by detail recreation of an entire Houston airport terminal.
Yeah, and a giant crib and bedroom set for a
baby. Well, yeah, and then there's the episode three, a man-sized baby, but the episode three where he basically recreates the life of Captain Sully Sullenberger, you know, and lives his experience so he can learn how to be courageous and how to make decisions like Captain Sully did.
Yeah, I think the rehearsal in general, the two seasons, it's very different from Nathan For You, which was very limited by like a Comedy Central cable budget. So the joke in those episodes in Nathan For You was convincing small business owners of a crazy idea and then pulling that off. The joke in rehearsal seems to be just the lengths to which HBO is willing to spend on these elaborate sets and hiring all these actors and just making big productions out of what end up being, you know, like 30-second jokes, basically.
Basically, although I feel like, you know, there have been quite a few, you know, air disasters in the last year, a lot of close calls, ongoing troubles at Newark Airport, you know, so and in its own way, the rehearsal manages to be on the zeitgeist when it comes to the current state of air travel, which is actually very, very safe, mm-hmm. percentage-wise still. But, you know, I think that it does kind of get at some of these neuroses people have about flying.
Yeah, the timing is very, very prescient. I mean, it landed right when that stuff was happening, the first episodes of the season. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of fanfare leading up to it. Like, I don't think we even knew that the topic was air.
We didn't know the premise, air travel.
Until, you know, like, yeah, right before it came out. It has real world implications, more so, I think, than the first season, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, what I liked, the first season was really good, but it was also like, I mean, I suppose there was a universe in which you could predict some of its subject matter, whereas this, you know, was about, it still had some of the same sort of awkward relationship stuff, but it more than that, it was about something tangible. And it had some, there were some politics to it, and it had more depth.
Yeah, I think Nathan Fielder's finales are always trying to go out on a very catch you off your guard emotional note. I think the first season was about this kid attaching to him, and it sort of calls into question the whole premise of the show of like, is this bad? Is he harming this kid? And that left it on a very queasy note. The Finding Francis from Nathan For You, that, you know, the series finale of that was a very lengthy examination on loneliness. And I think he has a tendency to really save a huge kind of banger for last of his finales.
I felt like this season left us on almost an optimistic note. And I appreciate it as someone who's, you know, I've spent time in my life, you know, like becoming a yoga teacher or trying to become a professional poker player, you know, doing other things that sort of seemed a little bit outside of what would be normal and expected. I appreciated the fact that final episode where I'm like, oh, he actually became a commercial pilot. He became one.
Yeah, there's committing to the bit, and there's like, no, he obviously had some interest in this, or you can't spend 2 years doing something as a you know, as a bit or as a prank.
I mean, unless you can. I mean, it's like Andy Kaufman taken to the furthest reaches of sanity. All right, but I want to talk about something related to Nathan Fielder, right? You mentioned, you know, my wife, I wouldn't say she can't really stand him. You know, she really just like does not pick up what he's putting down. And you mentioned to me that someone you were involved with once said that you reminded them of Nathan Fielder, and you weren't sure.
My ex-wife.
That's how that went. Yeah. Well, if you want,
And she loved Nathan Fielder.
Oh, she did.
Yeah, she was a fan.
This is confusing. Well, if you want, I can hire an actress to play your ex-wife, and I could play you because I know you. I feel like I know you well enough. You know, and I could certainly study up, and you know, we could stage conversations about Nathan Fielder. I could play those videos for you if you need any kind of closure.
There's a group of about four or five comics that are in that orbit, that all kind of in that same kind of clique, that are either the significant other really likes them, or it's just kryptonite. It's just absolute. They just hate them.
And yeah, who else do you put them into there?
Him, Connor O'Malley, Tim Robinson, and I think also what's the other one? Joe Pera, who I absolutely love, but his grandfatherly kind of rhythms, like there are women who just hate it. There are women I know.
Well, my wife wouldn't be able to pick Connor O'Malley or Joe Pera out of a lineup, but I've talked to her about Tim Robinson, and she's like, I can handle him in small doses.
Yeah.
which is why I didn't take her to see Friendship.
Which I really enjoyed. Yeah, Friendship was great.
Yeah. So it's like kind of uncomfortable, like millennial male comedians.
Yeah. We've talked about How To with John Wilson. That also feels like that ties in somehow. I mean, this season I felt like there were some John Wilson kind of DNA in this season, and just the way the melancholy that kind of floats throughout it, and some of the just found footage of stuff. Yeah, it was interesting.
All right. Well, it's something else. It's something else. Season two of The Rehearsal is something that I think people are going to be talking about for a long time. An unforgettable season of television. And I'll always, you know, and I'll never fly. Look at flying on a commercial flight exactly the same way again.
One of my friends that's been watching The Rehearsal sent me a picture. They were flying recently, and they sent me a picture of two pilots, you know, sitting in, you know, out in seats and just not talking to each other.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a problem.
No, I was thinking about it. Like I was just on. I went to Greece on vacation, and in one day I flew from Crete to Austin through Montreal. So I was, you know, I so it was like, I'm like, yeah, Nathan Fielder is Canadian, so I'm like, is he in the cockpit?
It's possible.
I never found out. I was too busy trying to deal with the restless leg syndrome of the guy who was sitting next to me, which is a topic that I think Nathan Fielder should have addressed on the show. But anyway, look, Omar and I both recommend season two of The Rehearsal quite highly. It is airing. We're no longer calling it Max. We're calling it HBO Max.
Oh, gosh. Oh, gosh. We're doing this again.
Yeah, we are. We're doing it again. All right, Omar, I'm going to let you go, and then I'm going to go talk to the actor who plays you. He's actually in my kitchen waiting for me.
Oh, tell him I said hi, unless I'm not, unless I shouldn't.
We'll see how it goes.
Okay, thanks, Neil.
Everything you were, everything you've done has come to this. Ethan, the fate of every soul on Earth is your responsibility.
You gave him an aircraft carrier?
I need you to trust me. One last time.
Stephen Garrett, your country needs you. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to talk to me about the new Mission Impossible movie. You have to gather a team of multilingual misfits, and you have to do a lot of pretentious speechifying. You need to hang upside down by your scrotum from the Empire State Building or something. I don't know. There's a lot of betrayal. There's a lot of double crossing. There are a lot of characters who don't make sense.
You know what? Let me just add, Neil, you've never followed orders and you've never let us down. The world got another sunrise because of what you do on this podcast.
Is that right?
Is that right?
Yeah. I was like last night, I'm like, there's not going to be another sunrise. And then, you know, open my eyes at 8 a.m. and I'm like, oh, look, this one came up. I must be.
You did it. You did it.
Oh, man.
The chosen one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't. It's because I went to bed in a decompression chamber.
You crawled out of the primordial digital ooze to do this podcast.
I woke up next to Haley Atwell, which was, you know, not not the worst thing that's ever happened to me. Anyway, Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning is in theaters now, and you know, at this point, like this is like a movie that almost defies reviewing, right?
It's like a roller coaster ride. Like the review is, it's a roller coaster ride. It's exactly what you think it's going to be, which is, if you like it, it's great.
I don't love the Mission Impossible movies, I have to admit. I
don't think you like this movie, though.
I liked the 35-minute extended submarine action sequence.
That was pretty great, man.
Yeah, you know, that was extended. Like, that was Hollywood filmmaking at its finest, right?
Because it
didn't cut away. The only dialogue for like half an hour was Tom Cruise saying, "Torpedo tube."
Torpedo tube is the only, that is the line from the movie. That's the "you completely" line.
I just howled.
Torpedo tube.
I just howed with laughter when he said that. That was the only line for like half an hour. And that was the best, that to me was the best part of the movie, because he's doing this, you know, stupid thing where he has to turn this key and get this MacGuffin and, you know, out of this abandoned Soviet submarine and, you know, all that. But then like the way he gets into the submarine and gets to the submarine, it's all very like fun and like visceral.
It's totally fun. And then it starts slowly rolling off its like ledge that it's perched on, way in lower depths.
The deepest abyss of the Arctic Ocean, where only dragons live. You know, and it's like, you're like, oh man, boy, Ethan Hunt's really, really in a pickle this time.
Yeah. You know what I love, though, like from a point of view, the filmmakers, they're like, okay, we're going to have this like super long, extended like action scene, no dialogue, we're not going to cut away, it's going to be totally focused on this. And how are we going to get him out? We get him out through a torpedo tube. How do we express that without using dialogue? Ah, crap. I think we need him to say torpedo tube out loud so the audience knows what the hell's going on.
Torpedo tube.
That was the one little Achilles heel to that entire otherwise amazing, like, no dialogue sequence.
Far and away the best part of the movie, and one of the best parts of any movie you're going to see this year. The other extended action sequence was this amazing biplane chase.
That's pretty amazing, too.
Isai Morales as the absurd villain Gabriel is flying one biplane, and for some reason there's another biplane. They don't really explain why. There's just a guy in a red biplane. And Tom Cruise,
he's just a tourist. He's just tourist. He's like,
oh, he's just following
aerial
the
safari,
world.
Yeah,
on aerial safari, following the world's greatest villain around.
In the wrong place at the wrong time.
Interesting too. I mean, I want to add too. Like, I actually I was on a car junket in South Africa once, and I flew through that canyon in a helicopter, and we turned sideways. And let me tell you, it was terrifying.
Were you clinging to the wing? Were you outside?
No, I was in the hell. I was inside the helicopter. I was not having the G-forces buffet my leathery face back against my skull. Like, you know, so that, and that scene was good, but like a lot of the movie, I felt like there was a lot of intercutting. So you had that, and then you had the tension with, well, are they going to like manage to turn the knob or, you know, defuse the bomb? And it's like, just do show the, I wish they had done with the biplane scene what they had done with the others, because I felt like some of the other action scenes, there was like a lot of intercutting.
But they'll say, like, you know, do we really need two defusing the plutonium bomb sequences? It's same bomb, just like again. Like, why are we doing this?
Yeah, I just in general, like, this movie's so stupid. You know, it's like this evil AI wants to destroy humanity, but why would it want to destroy humanity? That, you know, what's its end game?
Yeah.
And then all that stuff in the command center with the president and the general. When Nick Offerman, who plays like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or whatever, has a death scene, I mean, I laughed out loud. It was so bad.
I just like at that point where you're talking, they cut back to the like CENTCOM, right? And it's the president and all the president's, you know, men, basically.
People, yeah. Right?
People. Although it's Angela Bassett as the president, which is awesome.
And Janet McTeer is one of the men.
One of the people.
One of the men.
They are clearly in a room that has no air conditioning because they're all covered in sweat. So much flop sweat on all of them. except for Angela Bassett.
Yes.
She looks beautiful.
She looks good. You know, and you know, obviously, like, Angela Bassett is the A-listest of A-list actors, and she gives the part as much dignity as that.
A little gravitas.
You know, but the thing is, more like, Nick Offerman was horrible. But you know who was good, though, was Tramiel Tillman from Severance as the submarine captain. That guy.
Oh,
that guy stole every. That guy stole every scene he was in.
That guy was pretty great.
What was he said? You pick the right guy if you want to poke the bear. You know.
He said everything with like a weird sexual energy too, which is I was like.
And he kept calling Tom Cruise Mister.
Mister. And Tom Cruise kept getting in his skivvies. He kept wanting to show his bare chest and his little black tighty whities.
Yeah, on a submarine, which
a submarine in a submarine, out of a submarine, anywhere. Yeah.
Anywhere. So, you know, he stole the show. The audience, I saw the movie with Love, Tramiel Tillman, but I felt like a lot of it was, there weren't a lot of scenes. There's just a lot of speechifying, people like giving speeches in each other's faces, you know?
It really is that. It's like a lot of pretty cool, if not amazing action, followed by really boring exposition scenes with people gritting their teeth and explaining how the world's going to end.
Yeah, and the relationships are like
everything. It's exhausting.
It's a lot, you know. That's not to say there's not some bravura filmmaking in there, because there is. But boy, like as a movie, you know, just like it makes the Fast and Furious movies look like a Strindberg or something. You know, it's so much.
Yeah, and it's almost three. I mean, what is it? 170 minutes is long.
Yeah, like, I'm like, who gives a shit? You know, just show me the submarine
torpedo tube.
And also Tom Cruise running.
Oh, always signature.
The scene where he's like he gets through. They're in London. He gets through some big fight, and then he's like, "I need to get to Luther," and then he runs. You could just take an Uber. You know, jackknifing his arms through the streets of London must runs like.
Ooh. Yeah, I mean, I think he thinks running fast is very impressive.
Just hop on a bus, dude. Come
it's
on,
really not that impressive, especially in wide shots. You have no sense of how fast he's going. You're just like, yeah, I guess he's running again. Okay.
It's funny when he runs. It's like, but that run through the streets of London. That was just ridiculous. So you know, there's just not like. Look, I mean, if you love the franchise, you will love this movie.
Yeah, and they have that 5-minute supercut montage of all the other 7 movies, just in case you forgot.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of flashbacks to previous movies, and including to stuff that, like, really we haven't seen in, like, you know, 30 years franchise. I mean, that's just, you know, it's insane that they try to make it a coherent story as opposed to, like, just a James Bond situation where it's, like, it's these individual things that are maybe lightly connected. So, you know, they try to make it, you know, and there's this, there's definitely, like, there's a Jesus-ifying of Ethan Hunt that I didn't really...
Oh, God. The Chosen One.
The Chosen One. That,
he's the Chosen One.
You know, the Destiny's Child. I don't know. I didn't appreciate that, really. Like,
no.
But you know what? But you know what? It's a summer movie. Summer is here. How did the audience in France like it?
They liked it just fine.
They're like...
C'est bien. Comme ci, comme ça. How did you feel about the callback to the first movie with that character they brought back?
Oh, that was ridiculous. So this is a movie that is very fond of itself, which I think reflects its star, Tom Cruise, who is very fond of himself. And, you know, this combined with the Lilo and Stitch movie, or Lilo and Stitch or whatever, you know, we had another big box office weekend in
movies
in
are Hollywood. Back.
So Tom Cruise movies is, are back. Yeah, movies are very back. And, you know, Tom Cruise's publicity campaign where he like scarfed popcorn at AMC's and, you know, and talked to the employees and all that. Very effective. There's a nice moment at the beginning of the movie where Tom Cruise says, "Thank you for coming to see the movie." You know, I appreciate the hard work that he has done really since 2020 of trying to keep movies alive.
So is this the final reckoning as far as you're concerned? So you think this is the last Mission Impossible?
Probably not. The end didn't, you know, the end didn't really indicate that it was the end. They could do another one.
They could. So it should be final ? Reckoning is really.
Well, it was really the final it was the final reckoning with the entity. But the entity is telling me that I have to go, Stephen. So I'm gonna leave you here but I want you to, meanwhile, you need to go to Vienna and run on top of a train inexplicably for like half an hour.
And pull out a 5D drive in 100 milliseconds.
Yeah, and insert it into a hole.
That's fair. I choose to accept that mission.
All right, this segment will self-destruct in 5 seconds. All right, thank you, Stephen. Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning is wrecking movie theaters everywhere right now. If you like those movies, you'll like this. If you don't like those movies, you definitely won't like this. It is very, very much of its genre. Stephen also went to Cannes and saw a bunch of movies and reported back to us. Thank you for your service, as always, Stephen. And thank you to Omar Gayaga, who discussed season 2 of Nathan Fielder's The Rehearsal with me. It's now on the newly christened, rechristened HBO Max. I'm Neil Pollack. I'm the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com, a product of Sea of Reeds Media. We cover the world of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. And we will be back next week with our 200th episode. Who'd have thunk it? Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production.